Okay. Who wants to clean and debone them?
I'll do it. What gives?
You want to do it?
Just wait till you see what I've got. It's the Wonder Boner.
The Wonder Boner?
Aw, you laugh now. Just watch. You just assemble the Wonder Boner stainless steel rods like this. Take the fish, find the top of the spine, slide him through the ring on the Wonder Boner, and... voila! The Wonder Boner. My wife would like that.
Introducing the Wonder Boner, the amazing new fishing tool that makes deboning fish a breeze. The Wonder Boner's unique design removes the bones from trout, char, and whitefish. Simply connect the appropriate size stainless steel rods, start the spine through the ring, and push the fish through. It's that easy. And the Wonder Boner comes with a polyethylene storage case that doubles as a base and a cutting board. Why go through the hassle of deboning a fish the old-fashioned way when the Wonder Boner makes deboning fish this easy?
Well, I think the Wonder Boner's a winner. So, Dave, where did you get the Wonder Boner? Funny you should ask.
Order your Wonder Boner now. Call 1-800-310-3039 and receive the amazing Wonder Boner for just $19.95. The Wonder Boner comes complete with three stainless steel rod tops and two extension rods and will debone fish up to 3 pounds. The Wonder Boner is the perfect gift for your fishing friends and your favorite chef. In fact, every tackle box and every kitchen should have the Wonder Boner. Call 1-800-310-3039 and order your Wonder Boner for only $19.95. 1-800-310-3039. Call now.
My wife would like that.
Everybody, I need to get myself one of those, a Wonder Boner, for all of my boning needs. Mike from Big Foamy Head sent me that. Thank you, Mike. Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. My name is Phil, and I'm your host today as we discuss all things molecular gastronomy, or cooking. Excuse me. I wanted to welcome a host of new listeners and all of my new food blogging friends from Taste Spotting and Food Gawker, and all the people who have just started listening to My Life as a Foodie and reading the blog posts. This show is definitely one of those shows that I've been waiting to do for a while, and I kind of baited everybody with a bunch of pictures, so now we're going to talk about it. I had every single intention of making this show just a simple recap of my molecular gastronomy class that I recently attended at Sur La Table with Peter and Joe from My Last Bite and her nephew Cody and my friend Jill. But after attending and letting it all soak in and thinking about it for a couple of days, and I mean for a couple of days, it struck me that maybe I need to take this thing a little bit deeper than I initially intended on doing. So, yeah, I'm going to cover the class. I'm going to tell you what we did, how we did it. I'm going to give you all the recipes. I'm going to tell you where you can get all the items you need to get started yourself, make it very approachable for you. But within the first 4 minutes of Chef Michael Young's introduction to us, it was apparent to me that the ideas that I had about what molecular gastronomy was, at least what it was to me, and how I wanted to approach it, was kind of exactly what I was supposed to be thinking in the first place, because I was confused, which, you know, I find myself being confused a lot anyway. But what he said right at the beginning became kind of the catchphrase for the day, which ended up being a memorable day for me anyway. But to begin, Chef Michael Young, who was our instructor, is young. He is a guy, maybe in his late 20s, good-looking Italian kid, very approachable, extremely knowledgeable on not only Italian cuisine, but all types of high-end cuisine, including molecular gastronomy. He explains to us that he worked at Cordon Bleu here in Pasadena as an instructor for a few years, and he came to know Hervé Thies, who we all know now to be the godfather of molecular gastronomy.
And I actually became very friendly with a gentleman by the name of Hervé Thies. Hervé Thies is considered to be
almost the father of this idea of molecular gastronomy. And in a very funny way, he almost says it jokingly. He calls it molecular gastronomy. And I was, we were discussing this a little bit before. Does anyone know the definition for molecular gastronomy? No? What do you guys think it means? Well, and that's a, probably a good answer. So.
Funny that none of us really had an answer. I mean, hell, I didn't know. I'm not going to raise my hand and embarrass myself. What is it? It's, I don't know. You know, I see it as a vehicle to play with my ingredients, take things in their natural form, in a fresh, natural state, and put them in an unnatural form or an unnatural state. And I love the idea behind people's approach to a dish. You know, take a slice of an orange, and then you bite into it, and suddenly you realize it's a sweet potato. You have sweet potato pie in your mouth. Tricked again, you know? That's what I think of when I think of molecular gastronomy. It's a vehicle to turn food into art and to make every dish a complete mystery. So this turns into a discussion about what food is and what art is. I mean, is it art or is it food? Because that's a really good question. And I think you have to answer that first before you can really start to understand what molecular gastronomy is and what it is you want to do with it. Because I have to wonder, is what we're doing with molecular gastronomy food or art? Because I'd like to think it's art, but is it really art?
People go on vacation, they have panzanella in Florence, and they come back and, oh my God, panzanella, and then they go on a two-hour speech about, you know, oh, I was in Florence, I saw the Uffizi Gallery, and I saw this, I saw that. Which, I mean, it's great, and it works in Los Angeles, but to a certain degree, it's not art. It's craftsmanship, and there's a big difference between the two. When I met Eric A, he's very much the guy that says, well, why do we sit in chairs when we go to a restaurant? Why do we sit in front of a table when we go to a restaurant? He was spending time with me in the kitchen, and he sees me whisking egg whites. And he says, well, Michael, why are you whisking with only one whisk? I don't know about that. He goes, use two whisks. Want to be faster? Picked up two whisks, and yeah, it was faster. So this is one of the things that we want to think about when we think about food, is why do we do the same thing over and over again? Is that art? I mean, that's the biggest thing, is it art? And as a chef, you have to ask yourself two questions. One, are you a craftsman or are you an artist? If I'm doing the same thing that everybody has done for generations, am I an artist or am I a craftsman? You know, I was using the analogy before, and after this we'll get into the kitchen because I'll talk all day. We were using the analogy of the Beatles. Beatles came out with Hey Jude. Wow. I mean, that's an amazing piece of art. Somebody covers Hey Jude. Somebody covers Hey Jude again. Somebody covers Hey Jude and covers the cover of Hey Jude. At what point is it no longer art, and at what point is it just a reproduction?
Okay, so great point, and something I had not thought about. Is this art, or is it craftsmanship? You know, I have to think that some of what we do in the kitchen is kind of a little of both. Mens a mens, as we say in Italian. Half of this and half of that. I mean, when you're roasting a chicken with vegetables, you put it on the table, and you feed your family, that's craftsmanship. But figuring out all the ingredients to that dish and the right combination, that's artistry. When you turn foie gras into cotton candy, that's definitely art. But if Farron Audrey's creation has been done and redone 30 times, I mean, by the time you do it and you reproduce it, is it art then? You know, that's a good question. I wish I had an answer. You know, much like third grade math, this class really made me think.
But these are things to think about. These are things, as a chef, you have to think about. I'm a fine dining chef. My job is not to feed you. My job is not for you to walk out of the restaurant full, holding your stomach, being, oh my God, that was so good. My job is to entertain you. And there's a difference. There's a major difference in that. Thomas Keller. Thomas Keller is not out to feed your stomach. He's out to feed your brain. Jose Andreas, same thing. So there's a big difference in that mentality. And understanding that will help you guys understand a little bit the idea behind molecular gastronomy. By the third person that does mango caviar, at what point, or the 400th person that does mango caviar, at what point is it no longer art and is it craftsmanship? Or is it just reproduction? So I highly recommend, if you guys get a chance, most of those, that idea is basically the subject matter behind Hervé Thiesse's new book, which is called Cooking, the Quintessential Art. If you guys get a chance to pick it up, it's really, really good. It just got released at the end of the last year. He co-wrote it with who's basically my favorite chef, and who I don't aspire to be like him, but he teaches me a lot by reading his materials, which is a gentleman by the name of Pierre Gagnier. Pierre Gagnier and Michel Brar are kind of who I look to start thinking about and spur conversations with myself. And they're a lot. If Adrien Ferrand and Jose Andreas are the scientists of it, Michel Brar and Pierre Gagnier are more like the psychologists. So it's always an interesting. If you ever come to my restaurant, you'll see me studying how people are eating and how they're touching their food and what they're doing, and I find that very entertaining.
So what I took from all of that was that a chef at a restaurant that serves food as art considers himself an entertainer. Or maybe somebody a chef who serves high-end food, fine dining type of food, considers himself an entertainer. And a chef that serves you food as food, that is, food that fills your belly, warms your soul, that's a craftsman. You remember the show Alice? Remember Mel? Mel's Diner? Fat bastard craftsman. That dude's a craftsman. Sandwiches, cheeseburgers, you know, eggs, four pieces of bacon. You go to Denny's, craftsman. Anyway, I'm getting off topic. But Don said years ago, man, he said, I consider you and I craftsmen in the kitchen. And we mold meals, we build recipes, we tweak ingredients until we have the right dish, just what we want to serve. Half artistry, half craftsmanship. And I always held on to that because I kind of thought it was kind of cool. Also, it seems more manly when you refer to two dudes cooking in the kitchen together, making a meal. If you call it craftsmanship, it doesn't seem as, yeah. But when it comes to plating a dish, stacking the food, designing how it's going to look, you know, garnishing it just right. Now, I think that's where art really comes in. I mean, that's when you become an artist. So, like I said, men's amends. So always strike a balance. So anyway, we break up into groups. We're a group of five. It's me, my friend Jill, Joe, her husband Peter, who's really funny, and her nephew Cody, who, I have to say, not only was a joy to finally meet him, but he's a consummate foodie. He'll eat anything. He loves ingredients. I dig people who love ingredients. And he's got a really bright future ahead of himself as a firefighter, whatever the hell it is that he decides to do with his life. He's just got the right attitude to do anything. Anyway, we're going to make apple caviar, which I've already made, thanks to Joe, mozzarella spheres, hot ice cream, which is a trip, orange and carrot foam, and candied apples. Pretty much fruit and cheese dishes here. And one of the more interesting things that I learned was why some of the things that I've already made were lighter on flavor than I anticipated. And like the apple caviar. You know, when I tasted the juice before I added the sodium alginate, before I made it, turn it into caviar, it was really rich. It was sweet, had lots of flavor. But by the time I got caviar balls prepared and I ate them, the flavor was kind of subdued. It was subtle. And the reason for this, Chef Young says, is because of the air. You know, when you blend this stuff with the immersion blender, the amount of air that's introduced into solution does two things. It makes it lighter, and it lightens the flavor, because there's air in it, and it lightens the color a lot. So the trick is to double up on flavor. You make things more intense than you think they should be, or simply let the solution sit for a while after you mix it, so the air gets a chance to kind of escape a little bit. I mean, I use the blender. He said that's even worse, because I used it on the pea ravioli, remember? But I let the solution sit for about 2 hours, so the air got a chance to move out. But I think it would have to sit for a long period of time before it finally left it entirely. But we're going to talk about a few things here. Some of the things you're going to need to make any of these dishes, you're going to need an immersion blender or a boat motor, as Emeril likes to call it. You can get these hand mixers at any appliance store, Target, any home store. Mine happens to be a Cuisinart, but you don't have to spend a lot of money. The more money you spend, the more durable it's going to be, and it won't break on you. You just need something that you can stick in a bowl and mix things up well with it. You'll need a squeeze bottle or a syringe to make the caviar. The bottles, the squeeze bottles look like these plastic ketchup or mustard bottles that you see at the hot dog stand at the stadium, except that they're clear, and the hole at the top is a lot smaller. You can also find these at like home stores where the kitchen items are. They're everywhere. The syringe is a better bet, because they tend to drop even-sized balls into solution. And you're also going to want to buy one of these flavor injectors that you see in the grill shops. They're used to inject marinades into roasts and chickens and turkeys, any large cut of meat that you want to inject flavor into. They've got a huge needle on them, and they're really kind of cheap. I think they're like $6. But you'll find a buttload of them around Thanksgiving, because people are still into this deep-fried turkey thing, and they inject flavor into the turkeys. I'd like to know when that fad is going to pass. Because every damned year we hear stories about Billy Bob dumb shit burning down his freaking house because he put a non-defrosted 20-pound turkey into a half-full boiling bucket of hot oil. Anyway, you're going to need one of those injectors. So a couple large porcelain or glass bowls. Don't use metal. They tend to have these adverse reactions to a lot of the chemistry and a lot of food, and they give off flavors that you really don't want. Glass bowls are heavy. They're not really that expensive, and they're really easy to clean. So get about 3 or 4 glass bowls so you can have them. And you can use them for a lot of other things but this. A digital scale is kind of important, too. Measuring cups and measuring spoons. Molecular cooking can be a lot like baking. Measurements of some ingredients are really critical, and especially critical when you're adding the chemistry, especially some that we're going to use. Most recipes call for grams, so if you buy a digital scale, make sure it measures in grams as well as ounces. And as for the chemistry, most of what we use can be purchased at Le Sanctuaire. So I'm going to include links to all the resources where you can buy the powders on the website, mylifeisafoodie.com. Just check it all out. Most of the powders are about $6, anywhere from $6 to $10 for about a pound. And a pound will last you so long, and by the time you run out, you'll probably be sick of doing it anyway. So knock yourself out. Buy the whole thing. Okay, so first thing, I'm not going to go in order. I'm just going to go in order, so I wrote a lot of this stuff down. First thing we made was apple caviar. Now, it wasn't the first thing we made, but it's the first thing you're going to make, because it's the easiest. You've seen me make it. You've seen Joe make it. You saw it on No Reservations, so it should be old hat to you now. You want 9 ounces of apple juice, 2 grams of sodium alginate, 18 ounces of water, and 2.5 grams of calcium chloride. Now, you're going to need the squeeze bottle for this trick and a small slotted spoon or a little wire strainer. Mix the sodium alginate with half of the apple juice. Use the immersion blender. Mix it all up completely until it's dissolved. Then add the other half of the juice. Mix it some more. And then pour through a strainer into the squeeze bottle. Cover that. Allow it to sit for about an hour. Let some of the air bubbles get out of there. And while that's sitting, you want to mix the calcium chloride with water. Stir that until it's completely dissolved, and then put it in the fridge to get it nice and cold until you're ready to rock and roll with the caviar. Now, after the alginate and the juice mix has sat for a bit, pull the calcic bath. We're going to call it calcic now because we're cool. You're going to pull that out of the fridge. Fill another bowl with cold, clean water. Now, this is going to be a rinse bath. Calcium chloride is like table salt, so it's really salty, and if you don't rinse things after putting them in a calcic bath, they'll taste salty or kind of, you know, chemical tasting. So you always want a rinse bath after calcic. Hold the squeeze bottle upside down over the calcic bath, about a foot above the calcic bath. Slowly start giving the bottle short squeezes. The juice and alginate mixture is going to hit the calcic bath, immediately hardens on the outside. So alginate, in the presence of calcic, hardens. It stays soft on the inside, but it forms a little film on the outside. And because you're dropping it from, you know, the height that you're dropping it, it creates a little ball. They're not going to look like balls right away. They'll look kind of like odd-shaped tadpoles or some other little swimmers that we know about. You know what I'm talking about? Anyway, so once you pull them out of the calcic bath, they become fruit caviar. They're perfectly round. So then allow them to sit in the calcic for about 2 minutes, and then take them out with a slotted spoon or a strainer, place them in the water bath, and then leave them there for about another minute, and then strain them back out, place the strainer on a clean towel or a Scott towel, pick up any of the excess water off of it, and then place them right on a serving spoon or a plate, and you, my friend, have just made fruit caviar. And you can do this with any kind of juice, carrot, grape, watermelon, cranberry, or you can do what Peter did. Listen, I jokingly said, we were making this, and I said, you know, my friends all told me I should try it with beer, but I didn't do it. So Peter turns to me, he goes, "Oh, booze." I looked at him and I go, "Listen, I must have met the man 20 minutes ago, and I already liked the dude. I mean, it's just, he's likable." I look at him, I go, "Dude, single malt scotch, single malt balls." He goes, no, wine." He turns to Chef Young. He says, "Hey, you have any wine?" Of course, you know, guy's got wine. So they'll hop on it. Sure enough, next thing you know, we got 9 ounces of wine, mixing it with alginate. And we mixed it with the alginate. We aerated the piss out of the wine. I mean, the wine couldn't have tasted very good after that. But we ended up making wine caviar, and it was great. I told Peter he was a genius. He goes, "No, I just got chutzpah."
"Will you stop it? Are you out of your mind?"
Wine caviar. See, that's my next one, I think. Okay, so next comes carrot foam. Now, this is really simple. It's so simple, it's stupid. It tastes like air. You probably saw this on No Reservations when you went to Farinandria. A Day at El Bulli. You see this thick foam? You dip your spoon into it. You put it in your mouth and you suck in. Gone. Just like that. Just gone. Just disappears. It's the oddest sensation ever. And it's the easiest thing that we made all day. First thing, you have to have carrot juice. All right, so that either requires that you go to the health food store and buy carrot juice or Whole Foods. Or maybe you own a juicer. And if you own a juicer, say salute to you, my friend. You're one step ahead of everybody. So in a bowl, you want 18 ounces of carrot juice, 3 grams of food-grade lecithin, and then fire up the immersion blender yet again. The trick here now is to hold the blender just under the surface of the liquid. You don't want to blend from the bottom. Blend it from the top. The foam's going to rise right to the top. And you can start scooping it off and continue to blend it. And you're going to have a shitload of foam, trust me. This makes a ton of it, so you can go nuts. Oddly enough, too, this was the one thing both Joe and I were looking forward to making the most, and we did it last, and it took the least amount of effort. But the best part, we had it over a bed of orange foam, which ended up tasting like a 50-50 bar. You remember those ice cream bars? There were orange on the outside, vanilla on the inside. Oh, righteously cool. So good. And listen, I'd go into the details of making orange foam, but it's a lot more detailed. Requires that you own a whipper and CO2 chargers. You know, quite frankly, it's not really on my immediate list of things to buy. But one of these days, I'm going to go over the recipe with you. I'll get it. We'll do the recipe together. But it was pretty damn cool. One of the coolest things I tasted all day were the mozzarella spheres. The concept of this is kind of the same as the yogurt spheres that Jose Andreas made that got Joe so charged up in the first place and started all this. What he did was he mixed yogurt and he basically put it in a spoon and just put it in an alginate bath, and it just kind of gave it a little skin. What we did was mix 250 grams of buffalo mozzarella. Remember, the freshest you can find. We might be using chemistry, but we still want to use fresh ingredients, all right? 150 grams of heavy cream, and mix that together. Now, this is a recipe I'm going to change right here. In the lab, we added 5 grams of calcium lactate. And both Jill and I thought the finished product, had kind of a chemical taste. I mean, something you can actually taste. It didn't taste natural. So I think I'd leave it out. And you can feel free to add calcium lactate if you want. But for this show, I'm leaving it out of mind. Anyway, mix the cream and the mozz together in a bowl. Blend it completely. And then in another bowl, mix a liter of water and 5 grams of sodium alginate. And hand blend that until it's completely dissolved. Then take an ice cream scooper or a tablespoon measure. Fill it with the mozzarella cream mixture. And then gently lay it into the alginate bath upside down on the spoon. So the bottom of the spoon into the alginate bath. Completely submerge it. And then turn it upside down into the bath and allow it to float in the alginate bath about 2 minutes. Then remove it. And what you end up with is a perfectly smooth ball of mozzarella. But when you bite into it, it explodes with a loose cheese texture that's similar to ricotta. It's very freaking cool. It's close to burrata, but not quite. Burrata is the real deal. It's like mozzarella that's not fully solidified on the inside. So it's mozz on the outside and still ricotta on the inside. Anyway, it's an Italian cheesy wet dream in your mouth. It's fantastic. So what you can do next, you take a nice smooth marinara sauce, put some into the turkey injector that you bought, right? Slide the needle into the mozza ball, fill it with the sauce. That way, when you bite into it, you get that nice cheesy marinara explosion. It's like magic. It's fun, right? That's about the time I really started to have fun with this. So I'm starting to think maybe the alginate bath is what gave it the chemical taste. Maybe it needs a rinse after that. That could be it. It might need a rinse after the alginate bath. That could be giving it the chemical taste. Who knows? Anyway, on to the hot ice cream, which I don't think there was a person in the entire room that didn't like it, that I knew of. But this is where things got cool for me because Chef Young just kind of proved his coolness. He's making this stuff right in front of us. He's dipping it in the hot water. It's falling apart. And he says nonchalantly, "Yeah, we should probably wait a while. It needs to be set some more." And I thought to myself, well, this guy's brave. You know, he's the instructor, and he's experimenting right in front of us. And someone asked us, "Have you ever made this before?" And he goes, "No, it's my first time. I'm learning with you." Now I'm thinking, now that's cool. It's fearless. I mean, this thing could not work at all. And he could look like a failure to some of these people, but he's all right with that. You know what he says? He says, "None of these recipes are set in stone. You're going to play with them. Make them work for you. They're like a framework. We're not baking a cake. We're in a lab." And he said, "This is exactly what they do at El Bulli. They play with the ingredients and processes until it works exactly how they want it to." And holy shit, those were exactly the magic words I needed to hear. If I felt any pressure at all to impress a professional executive chef with my ability to follow instructions, it was all gone right then. I mean, we're experimenting in the lab. Sir El Bulli. So, hot ice cream. In a blender, puree 300 grams of yogurt, 230 grams of cream cheese, 80 grams of agave nectar, which is twice as sweet as sugar. You can find this at Trader Joe's, Whole Foods. It's agave nectar. It's from, you know, the agave plant where they make tequila. A pinch of sea salt, and then scrape a vanilla bean and drop the insides of the vanilla bean right in the mix. Cover that, blend it until it comes together into a smooth puree. But don't go past that point. The thing is, you don't want to aerate it. You just want it mixed. Now add 150 grams of water to a pot and put it on the heat. Once it hits the boiling point, take it off the heat, add 11 grams of methyl cellulose, and whisk that until it's completely smooth. Then add that to the blender with the mix and blend it all again until it's completely mixed, but not past that point. All we're trying to do here is to homogenize the cheese. We don't want to aerate it. We don't want to, you know, bring air into it. We just want to homogenize the cheese. Once that's mixed, pour all of it into a bowl and place that bowl in an ice bath. The idea here, you want this bad boy down to a cold point as quickly as you can get it there. Because once it's really cool, we're going to put it either in the fridge or the freezer. We want it cold. We want it to set. It's like making ice cream. If you've made ice cream, it's the same idea. You want it to set. And the preferable method here is to do it a day in advance, then leave it in there overnight in the fridge. You know, do it that way. But as the guy said in the intro for the bonerizer, or whatever the hell that thing was, voila, it's ready. it's set now. And it's set. You get another pot of water on the heat. Bring that to a boil. Now, you don't have to measure that water because that's going to be our bath. Once it hits a boil, turn it off, take it off the heat, then take a scoop of this ice cream mixture with an ice cream scooper, and drop it in the water. And the best way to do this is to lay the bottom of the scoop into the water first, off the bottom, and that loosens the ice cream from the bottom of the scoop. Then submerge the whole thing, turn it upside down, and the ice cream will just come loose in the water. And what this does is it kind of makes sure that the ice cream sets before it's dislodged in the hot water bath. Now just let the scoop of ice cream poach in that hot water for a full minute. And then once it's completely set, remove it from the water with a slotted spoon, drain it on a clean towel, place it in a serving dish, and then just garnish it if you want. You can just eat it if you want. But what you end up with is cold, ice-cold ice cream with a hot outside. It's one of the coolest sensations ever, and there's no cream in it. I mean, and the vanilla really makes it too. And you can experiment now. Go nuts. Chocolate, maybe put some nuts in there, you know, some candy. It's the methyl cellulose that keeps it all together and gives it that firm texture, and it keeps it from melting in the hot water. It's ultra badass. What a great trick. And, of course, it worked. So then the last thing we're going to make today here is actually the first thing that we made. It's called Pomme d'Amour, which are Michael Richards candy apples. To start this, you're going to want 3 Granny Smith apples. Peel them. Then take a melon baller and make small balls from the apples. Try to make a complete ball out of it. Then place a toothpick in each one. Sprinkle them with a bit of lemon juice. Keep the oxidation down to a minimum. And then chop or grind about 1/2 cup of pistachios into small chunks or fine powder. And then put that in a separate bowl. Now you're going to take in a medium saucepan, 1 pound of sugar, 4 ounces of glucose, and a teaspoon of red food coloring. Put that together, keep it over high heat, bring it all the way up to 310 degrees Fahrenheit, and then stir it so it doesn't burn. And keep it stirring, because once it's all melted, because it's not burnt, you know, you've got this nice, you know, it's not like caramel, it's just kind of a hot sugar solution. Remove that from the heat. Take the toothpick, dip the entire apple ball into the melted candy, cover it as completely as you can, and quickly now, place the new candied apple into the bowl of pistachios and cover as much of the candy as you can with the dust and the chunks before it hardens, which is going to be about 3 seconds. It is quick. If you don't want nuts, you don't have to do nuts, but they're damn delicious. Mini candied apples, and then call your dentist. You know, of course, at one point I'm trying to dip an apple ball into this stuff. And I pull it out, and some of that candy stuff starts to drip off. And me, being the supreme retarded dumb shit that I am, I put my hand underneath it so it doesn't fall on the floor. You know, like it should fall on the floor. That was smart. I burnt a nice size welt on my hand. So I have a little memento to remember the class by and the day. Anyway, that's what we made. So here, I'll tell you what the chemicals do, because they gave me a whole list of all the things that the chemicals do. And the chemicals that you need to buy from Le Sanctuaire or one of the other vendors that I'm going to list on the website, mylifeisafoodie.com. Lecithin. The lecithin that we use in the foam is a common food additive, and it mostly comes from soy. Most commonly comes from soy. It's an emulsifier. It allows water-based and fat-based substances to stay in a state of emulsion, and that's important. The methyl cellulose that we used in the hot ice cream is derived from cellulose and dissolves in cold liquid, but not in hot. It's a common thickener that you find in ice cream and toothpaste. We use glucose in the candied apples. That's sugar in its absolute simplest form, and it's usually referred to as grape sugar. In beer, I think it's 100% fermentable, but I need a book in front of me to tell you for sure. Anybody know the answer to that? Is glucose 100% fermentable? Chug-a-lug-a-ding-dong. Anybody? Nope. Okay, calcium chloride, also referred to as calcic. We use that in the fruit caviar. Like I said, that hardens algin. In the presence of algin, it hardens it. It's what takes the gel mixture that has algin in it and makes the outside firm, creates a small little film around the chewy goo. So the reason we use water bath, like I said, was because if we didn't, we'd have really saltiest balls. We'd have the saltiest balls in our mouth, and we don't want that. And finally, the sodium alginate. This is very important that you pick this up. It's a thickening agent. It's derived from the cell walls of brown algae. And it's used as an emulsifier or a thickener. I left this thing so energized and really ready to conquer the world of molecular cooking, I'll tell you. I love the kitchen. I love being around a professional chef. It just solidified it for me. It was just a great day. And I would do it again if I didn't think I knew it all now. In any event, I'm ready to take it on now. I'm going to start putting out new dishes. I'm going to share everything that I do on the blog. So keep your eyes on the blog, mylifeisafoodie.com. And if you ever make any of these things, send pictures, post them. Post them on the site, do anything. Let us know how it's going. I'd love to see more people doing this and just share it. And if you need anything from me, please don't ever hesitate. Just send me an email or just post. And don't forget to check out the slideshow. Joe took a bunch of pictures. And I'm going to make a slideshow of those, and that'll be on the blog as well. It's right in the post for this episode. I'm thinking I'll put it on Vimeo or something. Anyway, check it out. She took a ton of pictures. I think I took one. I don't know what the hell I was doing. I took one picture. And listen, if you're interested in getting into this, don't forget to check the resources. I'm going to put all the resources on the site. Le Sanctuaire, a bunch of other places on the web. You can get the ingredients and the tools. experiment with molecular gastronomy at home. It's a lot of fun. And don't forget to check out Joe's site, too, mylastbite.com. She's got adventures, loads of stuff. She's been doing this a lot longer than I have. She's got more experience than I do. She's got a lot of other sites, Alini at Home, Chadzilla. I'm going to have all your resources there. So later that day, we're at Joe and Peter's house. We're up for an Oscar watch party. They invited us over. And any of you who listen to the show or have listened to Dude Night in the past know how into movies I am. I mean, I love movies. I love the process of making movies. You know all the extras they put on a DVD? They make that for movie nerds like me. The acting, the writing, cinematography, art direction, lighting, especially music. It's one of those passions of mine. It always has been, even since I was a kid. It started with my mom. And I'd watch movies with my mom. And we'd watch the Oscars together. My mother loved movies. And I think because it was an escape for her. You know, for 2 hours, she could just kind of pretend that she was having a different life that didn't so closely resemble hers. I don't know. I think that's why a lot of people watch movies. It's an escape. Anyway, Oscar season has always been something that I just love ever since I was a kid with my mom. I wait for it all year. I follow the Oscar race as early as March or April, when the so-called sleeper films are screening at independent film festivals like Sundance, Cannes, South by Southwest, and the Toronto Film Festival. Oscar Sunday is always a special day for Katrina and I. She watches the red carpet stuff, and I prepare a special pre-Oscar meal, and then after dinner, we sit down, we watch the Oscars. We fill out little tally sheets. We bet on the Oscars, each category. Just one of the things. It's kind of fun. So I've never actually been to an Oscar party where people, you know, we watched it in a group, like the Super Bowl. So I knew it was going to be a lot different. And believe me, we were with a crowd who were really into movies, so it was really fun for me. But the best part of the whole experience, of course, was the food, because there was tons of food there. You know, you're at a foodie's house, there's going to be a lot of food. There are 3 or 4 tables laid out, plates and bowls, filled with so much incredible food. So I'm trying a little of this, a little of that. Everything's delicious. I'm trying to, like, you know, not eat too much. Then I see this big platter of rice and peas and meat and 2 giant grilled chickens sitting right on top. They looked like they had some kind of spice on them, and they were grilled to perfection. I had to have that. So, you know, cut off a leg or something. Oh, God, it was good. It was out of my head. It was perfectly grilled chicken. It was moist, flavor all the way through, really good depth of flavor, super crispy skin. I mean, seriously, a whole grilled chicken. That's a feat. Any of you guys who have ever tried to grill an entire chicken, even on a rotisserie, know just how hard it can be to accomplish it without burning not only the chicken, but your grill and maybe your house down to the ground. It takes patience, skill, a little experience. So immediately I'm thinking it had to come from a restaurant. And maybe this was one of those catered dishes. So then I meet Joe's friend Afaf and her husband Ray, who, no big surprise to me since they're friends with Joe, 2 of the warmest, friendliest people you'd ever want to meet. She knew about my blog. She knew I was a friend of Joe's from online. Really complimentary person. Kind of people that you meet them and you hug them because they're huggers. Turns out Afaf is from Syria, and apparently she loves to cook a lot. She says to me, "Did you like my chicken?" I looked at her and I said, "This one? You made that?" I'm looking at Katrina. She's shocked. I said, "Oh my God, that was incredible. When how the hell did you pull that off? 2 perfectly grilled whole chickens." She says, "Oh, I just put them on the grill for a couple of hours. You know, no big deal. Just like that. I just put them on the grill." Suddenly, I'm looking at this woman in a whole new light. Talented on the grill, modest about it. Not really 2 traits that go together generally. Most grill masters are pretty arrogant, and they'll let you know just how good they are about every 10, 15 minutes. But listen, with her, it doesn't end there. She says, "Did you try my other food?" And I'm like, "Are you kidding me? There's more food?" She takes us to the 3rd table, contains 4 more platters of her food. And I'm not kidding you. She made baked eggplant with Parmesan and marinara sauce, topped with sun-dried tomatoes that were really super soft, an antipasto green bean dish, a platter of Syrian meatballs, which I'm going to have to tell you about in a second, perhaps maybe one of the best condiments I've ever had on anything. It was a special Syrian type of sauce or a paste that was made with red peppers and a bunch of other ingredients. I can't even begin to tell you or figure out what the hell was in that. You wipe that on whatever you're eating, particularly the meatballs. Unbelievable. Spicy, rich, deep in texture, full of flavor, like one of the red mojo sauces, the Spanish red mojo sauces. I want to bathe in it. That's how good it was. So she says it's a specialty from Syria, and she made it herself. I'm looking at her husband, Ray. I said to him, I go, dude, you're perhaps the luckiest man I've met in a while. You married very, very well. He says, yes, I know. Thank you very much. So these meatballs. She made these meatballs. I can't even describe these things. They're meatballs stuffed with meat. That's how she explained it. I'm like, what? It's meatballs stuffed with meat. And they had a crust on them like a kiwi fruit. You ever felt one of those? They seem like they're breaded or pan-fried, but they're really light. Like if you eat a meatball, it's just a meatball. It's meat, right, all the way through. But this seemed like it had like a meat pocket, but there wasn't any bread on it. It was a light, airy meatball that didn't really eat like a meatball. It was ridiculous. You slather some of the spicy Syrian sauce on one of the meatballs. Let me tell you something. Heaven. The thing is, I'm already stuffed when I meet Afaf, but she's laying down all these incredible dishes on me. I'm not going to say no, but my knees are buckling. I'm holding onto the ropes, you know. I'm trying not to hit the mat. But I got to try the eggplant. So I do, and it's unreal. It's like an Italian classic. Rich marinara sauce, little melted cheese across the top, eggplant perfectly cooked. Seriously, I couldn't believe she can nail eggplant parmesan on top of the other variety of food she made. But that was it. It killed me. I'm going down now. I couldn't hold on to the ropes. TKO, fourth round. Afaf wins, retains the belt, whole thing. So as it turns out, as Ray told me, Afaf was not raised to cook. She didn't really start cooking until about 20 years ago, I think, is what he told me. She learned the basics, became a passion of hers, and she took off with it like a rocket. Ray tells me he comes home from work. She'll have been cooking all day. The house smells fantastic. She lays out all these little incredible things. And I looked at her. She's standing there just smiling like it's no big deal. She probably has no idea how awesome a feat it is to be able to do that. A lot of people just don't have the guts to cook that way. Not to mention the skill and patience to try so many new things, to cook such a variety of food and do it that well. And she pulls it all off. And it came back to me from what Chef Young said. And the reason why I'm including this story, Afaf is an artist and a craftsman. In no way, shape, or form can you say she's not on top of her game as a home chef, craftsman, or artist. I think I met that night one of the single most passionate cooks I've encountered in a long, long time. Obviously, she's a person who loves ingredients, loves playing with the textures and flavors, bringing all these dishes together, and that's artistry. And in doing so, and building it, that's craftsmanship, because it takes an artist and a craftsman to build those meatballs. I don't know how she does it. And I'd never tasted a single thing from Syria before, and suddenly, Syria seems like a food mecca. And I found out later that she once planned a surprise party for one of her friends, and she didn't cook all day. She cooked all week. Now, you know anybody who cooks all week for a party? My friend Jill. She once cooked for a surprise party for Don. And I'm telling you something, the attention to detail that she put into this was amazing. She cooked for a few days, and there was a ton of work that went into that. That's a lot of work. It's a lot of planning. You really have to have your shit together to pull something like that off. Do it for an entire week. Forget about it. So, here. I raised my glass to Afaf, a woman who showed me no mercy that night. My stomach was shown no mercy. I said I wish I had two stomachs. I could have eaten more. I really have to find out how she made that sauce. I'm serious. You guys, you could eat it on anything. If you like spicy food, that red pepper, it's like red bell pepper, I think, and then there's some spice on top of that. That just brings it up, and it's sweet, and it's hot. You could slather that on a tennis racket, and I'd eat it. So cheers to my new friends, Afaf and Ray. Salud. So season 5 of Top Chef wrapped up this week, and if you haven't seen it, I'm about to screw the whole thing up, spoil it all for you, right here. The final three chefs left after Fabio was released, I figured he would be. Stefan, which is the arrogant German. Hosea, the seafood guy who struggles to cook fish. And he's also Stefan's arch nemesis. And Carla, who's the nicest person ever in Top Chef. Seriously. I mean, Stephanie was nice last year, but Carla's crazy good. Nobody thought she'd make it to the final. She's been solid all the way through. Anyway, this final set in New Orleans. They came from New York, set in New Orleans. Fabio was released last week. Who I guess he didn't impress the godfather of Bourbon Street, Emeril Lagasse. And this show starts with the three contestants enjoying breakfast together at the Creole Queen, which is right on the water. New Orleans is so damn cool, man. Gotta go there. Anyway, here it is. The final elimination now begins. Listen.
Congratulations, Stefan, Carla, and Hosea, for making it to the final challenge, which will determine who will win $100,000 and the title of Top Chef.
For your final challenge, it's a pretty simple one. Cook us the best three-course meal of your life. We want to see the fire, the passion, and the soul, but more importantly, it must be delicious. You can use whichever proteins you like. You'll be cooking head-to-head and serving us simultaneously. Again, it's a three-course meal. You do not have to make a dessert. That's entirely up to you.
I don't know if you're happy when Tom tells you, hey, you can make whatever you want to. You kind of like, you sit there and say, what am I going to make now?
You'll be serving to a table of 12 judges and distinguished guests. You'll have 2 hours to prep tonight at the Audubon Tea Room, and tomorrow you'll have 3 hours to cook at Commander's Palace.
And of course, we arranged for some help.
You know what's funny? I just noticed this. I got a bunch of audio from Top Chef. I mean, I'm going to play a lot of it. This show is so damn long. It's crazy. What's funny about this, and I just noticed it now, early on in Top Chef, go back and watch an episode. Early on in an episode, the music is upbeat, and as it goes, it gets more and more dramatic. By the end, it sounds like a freaking funeral dirge. You notice that? It's ominous music at the end, but at the beginning, it's all yucks. You know, of course, like every Top Chef finale, they always have a twist. At least one twist. But this time, they're getting help. Last week, they got help from other contestants from this season. This time, they're getting help from other seasons. Each contestant draws knives, determines which order they're going to select, who they're going to cook with. The help comes from runners-up from previous seasons of Top Chef. You got Marcel from Season 2, Casey from Season 3, and Richard, the molecular gastronomy dude from last season. Hosea ends up with Richard, Stefan gets Marcel, and Carla gets Casey. Now listen, I liked Casey on Season 3. A lot of guys I know said she only got there because of her big tits. And I thought that was unfair. I mean, she's a really good chef. She was all the way through the competition, she was a good chef. And yeah, it's nice to see her getting a hot tub in her bikini. Nothing wrong with that. But it has nothing to do with her cooking. In the final, she sucked. She tanked. And it opened the door for Hong to beat her ass. He was probably going to beat her anyway. But she really fell hard. So for what it's worth, Casey was good up to the final. She's like the A-Rod of Top Chef. Speaking of A-Rod for a second, let me get off the subject. I love this whole controversy right now that's surrounding him on the steroids thing. They say it helped him win the MVP and now his numbers are tainted because he admitted taking steroids. Somebody posted somewhere, they wonder if steroids don't work in October. If you know anything about A-Rod, it's hilarious. Because he is notoriously a great player all season. But in the postseason, he's like Mr. July. He's got like a 150 batting average in postseason play or something really bad. He just closes up. He's a great player. And then as soon as the postseason comes, he sucks. Anyway, Top Chef. So they get in the kitchen, and Hosea is being a dick to Stefan, who totally deserves it because he's been a dick all season. But Hosea is being really rotten. There's like 6 packages of foie gras, and he takes all of them. There's like 6 or 7 tins of caviar. He takes like 4 or 5 of them. It's like, dude, come on. You know, win fair, share the ingredients, cook your way to the final. Anyway, we start to see something going on with Carla and Casey. And it's that Casey's starting to talk to Carla, and she's making her do things she's not comfortable with. I don't know if she thinks she's trying to make up for the fact that she didn't win. But Carla, you know, is willing to try it because either she feels like it's worth the risk or she just doesn't want to say no to Casey because she likes her, she respects her, or she's just trying to be nice. Because she is like one of the nicest people you've ever seen in a Top Chef kitchen. Now listen, if I'm in this situation and someone suggests I make a New York steak and I've never cooked a New York steak before, I'll say, you know, it is a steak. I can cook steaks, roasts, whatever. No problem. I'll do a New York steak. But if someone says cook a New York steak using a vacuum seal in a water bath at low temperature for a long period of time, which is also known as sous vide, which is not a real easy thing to master if you've never done it before, I'm going to tell them to grab the tongs, fire up the grill, and we're going to grill the steak. Because I don't know about you, but if I'm cooking a steak, it's going to be on the grill or in a pan. There's the two ways that I cook a steak, and it's usually on the grill. Because it's all I know. I'm not going to let you talk me into cooking it sous vide if you took your top off. No way, not in a final. But this is what happened to Carla. She got talked into cooking her steak using a preparation she's not familiar with. And the judges thought it was so tough that they could see marks where the jockey was hitting it, to coin a phrase from the late great Rhonda Dangerfield. But not only that, she wanted to make a tart for her dessert, but head Casey talked her into doing souffle instead. Ask me how the souffles turned out. Yeah, it's like that. Shit. She imploded, man. It was sad. It sucked. So, Hosea makes an appetizer with redfish, a first course of sashimi and citrus, a second course with foie gras and apple compote, and finished with venison. Pretty heavy meal. But it's his final challenge. It's up to him what he wants to cook. They said he didn't have to do dessert, so he didn't. Stefan makes an appetizer of alligator soup, a sliced carpaccio salad, which he kind of screwed up because he froze it first and then sliced it thin, and it made the whole thing watery. And then a squab and foie gras main course that they fell in love with, and then a dessert plate of chocolates and ice cream that didn't really seem to impress the judges that much, even though it was dessert. Then Carla made a Southwestern-style amuse with crab, a black bass bouillabaisse second course, which the judges loved, and then that sous vide New York steak, it was kind of tough. And the sauce they liked. They said the sauce was excellent. And then this anemic cheese plate for dessert that didn't feature the souffle because of head Casey. Kind of sucked for her. She's been the strongest dessert person all season, and she wanted to make that tart, and she didn't. Anyway, here's the judges' table. Here's what the judges had to say to them.
First, I want to congratulate you for making it to the finale. And I want to also thank you for a wonderful meal this evening.
Thank you.
Carla, I thought your appetizer course was really well done.
I wanted to do something kind of bold and spicy. And then this chayote squash, which I've been dying to use since I've been here. So I was like, oh, this is the perfect opportunity.
Carla, your first course was the bouillabaisse.
I enjoyed the flavors. I thought the fennel was well done. I thought the sauces were well done. I liked the clam on it.
I loved all your flavors. I thought they were spot on.
What did you think of her meat and potatoes course?
The sauce was good.
And everyone at the table noticed that the major problem I had was the texture of your meat.
I thought the problem was that it was far too refined, as we say in Britain. It was a kind of rather polite, rather fussy, rather anemic little dish. I wanted something much bolder, much bigger from you. That's what I was expecting from you. That's what I've come to expect from you.
Mm-hmm. How much influence did Casey have? What kind of suggestions did she make?
She made a lot of suggestions. I know, for instance, the sous vide. I was like, okay, I'll try that. You know, I know about it. I don't do it.
Let's talk about the cheese course and the missing souffle.
I could not put that souffle on. What I did, I forgot to turn the oven down. When I put the souffles in, I looked in and they were bubbling. I was like, they're curdled. There was no recovery.
Why a souffle?
Casey said, well, what about doing a souffle? I was like, well, that'll be really cool because the custard souffles when you bake it.
So originally your plan was to make the tart.
Right.
But Casey suggested that a souffle would be more appropriate, perhaps.
Well, she said, oh, let's jazz it up a little bit.
It seems that you let your sous chef talk you out of cooking the food that got you to the finale. And I'm not quite sure I understand that.
Right.
So, Hosea.
I thought your hors d'oeuvre was excellent.
Thank you.
Have you cooked redfish before?
Maybe once.
It's an interesting flavor. It's very strong.
Yeah, it definitely is strong. You know, I wanted bold flavors. The whole idea of my menu tonight was cook big flavors. I like strong flavors and something you remember. You know, I had a slight advantage being able to pick the protein for the past hors d'oeuvre. And honestly, I would have been happy with any of the three, but it was fun being able to dole out the, you know, the order.
So it was fun to stick it to Stefan, is that what you're saying?
It was, you know, he would have done the exact same thing to me, I guarantee it.
Your sashimi. Were you happy with the seasoning and the way it tasted?
Raw fish is something that I do in my restaurant. I like a lot of acid. I like heat. I was really happy with the presentation. I thought all the colors looked great on the plate.
It was very fresh, very light, but I didn't feel as though there were enough citrus flavors in there to really bring out the best in the dish. What about in the next course?
I wanted to give a little nod to New Orleans. You know, the pan perdu was a way to do that.
I thought it was all very nicely done. And I thought that the apple compote was the perfect counterpoint to the foie gras. I thought that really tied together nicely. I enjoyed the dish.
I loved it. I thought it was great. I thought it was the best dish you did all night.
Yeah, it was delicious.
Thank you.
How did you decide to do venison?
It's one of my favorite meats. I wanted to end the meal with something big and robust.
It was nicely cooked. I thought the mushrooms were well done.
I really loved all of the different earthy components. The blackberry didn't really add anything for me. I couldn't really taste it in the sauce, so the garnish just was sort of a throwaway to me.
Right.
Clearly, you had the option of not doing a dessert. That was completely allowable. But typically, a meal has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Your meal had a beginning and two middles. You didn't think that was a bit of a risk?
Not really. I mean, for three courses, for me, I don't think dessert is necessary. I'd rather showcase my flavor combinations, my cooking, through savory dishes, then through dessert.
Stefan, have you cooked with alligator before?
No. It's really weird texture. I don't know what it is.
I thought your appetizer was very well executed.
The soup was flavored really well. I thought it was seasoned well. I actually thought that was a very nice dish.
Your first course, your carpaccio, when I tasted it, it tasted watered down.
Taking a piece of fish and freezing it to create something you can slice very thin and put on a plate, I don't get that.
But did it taste good or not?
I found it to be somewhat bland.
Gail, how did you like Stefan's squab?
I really enjoyed Stefan's squab. I thought it was cooked beautifully. The parsnip was a little sweet touch, which I liked.
I thought that was really your strongest suit.
It was a very strong dish. It's a very flavorful dish, and I thought it was the strongest dish of the night.
Yeah.
What compelled you to finish up with a dessert when you didn't have to?
I think when you have a proper menu and you eat appetizer, first course, second course, dessert, I think it's an end to a menu to have a dessert.
Do you think that that dessert was the note that you would want as the last thing we taste from Stefan?
Yes.
Carla, why do you deserve to be top chef?
I've proven that when I cook my food, it's really delicious. When I cook my food, there's a lot of heart, there's a lot of flavor. Do I think I am a top chef? Yes. Do I think that my food is good? Yes. When I make it, yes.
Oh, Carla. No, don't.
It's okay.
Don't. Oh, no. Can't see.
Oh, what the hell? This was unique, you know. Carla starts crying because she knows she's blowing it. She allows Head Casey to influence her decision. And now it's between Jose and Stefan. And of all people, Stefan comes over and starts consoling her because she's crying. I mean, this guy's been a prick all season. And all of a sudden now he's got a soft side. Where the hell was this a month ago? We could have been rooting for you if we didn't know you were a member of the Chef Gestapo. I mean, I thought you were, you know, insensitive. Anyway, here it comes. Ready?
Carla, you were really strong along the way. And when we see your food that comes from your soul and your heart, we love what we see. Hosea, put together a nice meal. You're very steady across the board. Stefan, you had some amazing highs, but you also had a few lows. Ultimately, we made our decision based on how well the meal tasted overall from start to finish.
Congratulations, Jose. You are top chef.
Ah! Congrats, buddy.
Thank you.
Congrats.
Yeah!
Congrats, buddy.
Wow.
Nice job.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Kevin.
Who just won Top Chef? Jose just won Top Chef. Yeah, he did.
And there it is. Hosea, winner of Top Chef Season 5. Katrina picked him from the very beginning, so I lose this year. Did you notice there wasn't a whole lot of fanfare when he wins. Seemed like there wasn't a whole lot of people happy for him except for Hosea. Anyway, good season, not great season, but, you know, even an okay season of Top Chef beats the hell out of anything on Food Network. Is that show Chopped even on anymore? Do they still have that going? Do you know? Yeah, I stopped checking. Listen, you know, I know this show's getting long, but I've got one more thing I want to talk about, molecular gastronomy, just to kind of wrap it up. A couple weeks ago, Joe sent me an email with a single one-word subject. It said, whoa. And I thought, wait a minute, what? I look inside. There's a link to a website. No words, just a link. I click on the link, and this webpage comes up, and it says, newsflash, Albert Adria to leave El Bulli. You know who Albert Adria is? He's Farhan Adria's brother. He's a creative force behind El Bulli. It says, according to an article in Spain's El Periodico. Dude, my Spanish sucks. El Periodico. Periodico. Boy, I really do. This, I need to get this fixed. Albert Adria has left El Bulli and the world of ultra-creative cooking. It appears that the pressure to maintain constant creativity has caught up with him. It will be interesting to see how El Bulli and the Spanish vanguard evolve without his underrated contributions. Now listen, to those of you who don't really know a lot about El Bulli or molecular cooking or follow the world of the most popular restaurants in the entire world, this would be the equivalent of John Lennon leaving the Beatles or Steve Carell leaving The Office or Kiefer Sutherland leaving 24. You follow that logic? I mean, it's huge. Albert Adria was the think tank behind El Bulli. Farhan Adria gets all the credit. Albert Adria did all the work. He set the stage. He wrote the play, directed the stars, did the lighting design, that kind of thing. I'm paraphrasing. I'm just saying that. I'm using that as an example. This was the guy. He was the mastermind behind the whole restaurant. A very big reason why it's been number one in the world for a lot of years in a row. I don't even know how many. So people are going to wonder, you know, is El Bulli going to go on? Yeah, I'm sure it's going to. I mean, it's going to be the same, probably. I don't know if it'll stay on top. I doubt that. I mean, Fat Duck has been on its tail forever. On its tail. It was probably going to be number one this year anyway. And people say that, you know, they thought the list was fixed. But, yeah, El Bulli's still going to be a top-tier restaurant. People are still going to clamor to go to it. But I think it's going to start to slip without him there. Absolutely. It'll take a few years before, you know, people start to see the effect of it, and maybe you'll be able to get a reservation there. Good luck. But it was a real shocker. I'm telling you, it's typical. The minute I get involved in anything, it goes right out of style or I bring it bad luck. I'm like a big black cloud. Next time you talk to Jeffrey T. at the Good Beer Show, ask him how well his Ball State football team did last year when I started watching them when they played. He was going on and on how they were undefeated. I go, great, I'll start watching. Oh, no, bad move. The minute I start watching them, they tanked. They even ended up losing their bowl game. And they were playing a team that was like, you know, had four more losses than they did, and they lost to them. Oof. You don't want me as a fan. Hey, listen, just a quick heads up here. The next episode of My Life as a Foodie, as well as a short movie that I have in the works, for all of you, it's going to be a bit different than what you've come to expect from me here. It's not going to be a whole lot of yucks, if you know what I'm saying. Now, I've got something in the works that's either going to turn your heads or turn your stomachs. But I've always been about the truth behind our food and how we really need to be responsible eaters and that food does not come prepackaged. It doesn't come cleaned and skinned, you know, and in the cooler. Two- and four-legged animals feed and nourish us. And the truth of the matter is, they're alive, they live, and they have to die in order to feed us. So I'm going to be focusing on that just a little bit and hopefully uncover some of the myths and face firsthand the termination of an animal who will eventually feed a family. So the way it looks, I'm going to be going to a farm and bringing some of that back. So more details later. I just wanted to let you know what was ahead for the show. And you can either look forward to it, you can choose not to listen, or watch or whatever, I'll completely understand. I just think it's a responsible thing to do for me. And probably responsible for you too if you're really into it. But believe it or not, I am talked out. I'm done. I'm dry. This is a really long show, and I'm glad you hung out, any of you who are still listening. I hope you have a better understanding of molecular gastronomy now and cooking, as Hervé Thys says. And if you've ever thought of trying it, you see how approachable it is, how easy it might be for you to just get artsy, play around with ingredients, food-grade chemistry in the kitchen, design some new things you may want to try, express your creativity. It's a lot of fun. Believe me, it's a lot of fun. If you're near a Sur La Table or another gourmet cooking store in your area that offers classes, check them out. See if they have molecular gastronomy classes. Attend one of those. And they're not the same as the class we attended with Chef Young, but they will certainly, you know, allow you to learn a lot about the process, you know, figure out how to do it, and have a lot of fun. Now visit mylifeasafoodie.com. I'm going to have links to all the resources. Check out Joe's slideshow that we're going to make of all the pictures that she took. You'll have areas there you can buy all the ingredients. And I wanted to thank the band Andane for the music in this episode. If you like it, buy the song 99 cents, you cheap bastards. Kick down a buck, will you? In the iTunes store, visit mylifeasafoodie.com. Click the direct link to purchase the song. Until next time, which will be a lot different than this, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Di salute.